Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to today's Football Times from These Football Times. I'm Stephen Scragg, and we've got a special one tonight. We've got a bit of a celebration. 40 years since, scurvily 40 years, since Aberdeen won the 1983 European Cup Winners' Cup. A topic close to my heart, the tournament, the European Cup Winners' Cup, for obvious book-writing reasons. An amazing achievement. One of the greatest achievements of any British club in European football. Tonight, my co-host is Dave Bowler. Dave, looking forward to this?
Very much so. Always good to talk about Aberdeen, my adopted club. I do a fair bit of work for them. And just this last weekend, the club and the Gothenburg greats got the freedom of the city in Aberdeen. So we did a special programme for the Hibs game at the weekend. So there's been plenty of thought about 1983 in this household for the last few weeks.
A collector's item for certain. And tonight we have a special guest as well, the voice of BBC Radio Scotland on that amazing rainy night in Gothenburg back in 1983. The commentator, the legendary, I would like to call him, David Begg. David, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here, and especially to talk about the Dons.
Oh, it's going to be a joy, and it's brilliant to have you on. I mean, David. Tell us what I mean. We'll just sit enthralled in this. You know, the experience of being sat behind the microphone that night in Gothenburg in 83.
Well, I've got to take you back further than that, way back to 1952, when our family moved to a little town called Afford, or Alford, as they might say in Lincolnshire, but Afford. And my father's cousin was the then captain of Aberdeen Football Club, a guy, Jimmy Mitchell. My mother used to say to the boys, there was two other brothers, right, John, you'll support Hibs. She couldn't quite bring herself to say, you'll support Celtic, because she was a wee lassie for Govan. So you'll support Hibs, John. Tom, you'll follow your grandfather and support Rangers. Her father was actually a minister who used to go alternate weeks to Ibrox and Parkhead. And he used to be welcomed in as, come away, Ben, father, because they didn't realise he wasn't actually a priest when he went to Parkhead. So, and then she said to me, and you'll support the local team. And of course, the local team, when we got to Afford, was Aberdeen. And you can imagine my pride when Jimmy Mitchell came to visit in the family home. I got to meet him off the bus and walk hand in hand. And that team won the league in 1955. Barton, Mitchell and Smith, Alistair Young and Glenn, Leggett, Yorson, Buckley, Wishart and Harder. And they were my heroes, absolute heroes. So right through the 60s and 70s, when we moved away from Afford, we moved in 1956, I was a Dons fan, but not terribly active. Didn't go back to Pittodrie very often, just watched from afar. If they came to play in a cup final in Glasgow, then I would try and get tickets for those games. And then, of course, I got the opportunity to start to do some broadcasting. It was a strange thing. A guy, Jock Brown, whom you may remember, did a lot of work with Scottish Television, BBC before that. He then worked for Celtic, and he was leaving to go to STV. And the late Murdo McPherson, who was the producer in those days, said, I can't find anybody. I said, oh, what's that? Can't you find me? He said, I can't find anybody to take over and do the commentaries. So Roddy Forsyth, whom you will know the name, writes for the Telegraph, also broadcast for Radio 5. He and I got test commentaries for 10 minutes, because in those days, you didn't get to do the full game. The late Desmond White used to think that radio would keep people away from football. So in the end, to cut a long story short, I got a chance to do a few commentaries, starting off with Dundee against A United in the autumn of 1980. And then I gradually got a few more games. And luckily enough, I was chosen along with the great David Francey, who really was the legend of radio broadcasting, to go to Gothenburg on that wet night. But of course, the run starts before then. And certainly the game for me, above all games, was the game against Bayern Munich in the quarterfinal. And the Dons were trailing with, you know, about a quarter of an hour left, 2-1 behind, not looking likely. And then they got the old mix-up routine. Gordon Strachan and McMaster bumping into one another. Bayern dropped their guard. McLeish headed home. Game on. And less than a minute later, Aberdeen score again through John Hewitt. And a huge fan picked me up and said, "Biggin, it's a goal." And the two of us are lying across the seats. There's no days you weren't segregated. We'd been booted out of the commentary box. "Biggin, it's a goal." And I'm still jabbering on. And meanwhile, it's pandemonium in the stand that night. Wee Alan Green is covering his head with his hands. And Radio 5 switched to us to finish the game, saying there had been a technical problem. The technical problem was he couldn't cope with it. Then you've got the semi-final against Watershire, because the Dons absolutely horsed them in the first 3 or 4 minutes. They got a couple of goals very early on. And the fifth goal is the one I always remember, when it was in, no, it wasn't, yes, it is, no, it isn't. And a guy said he had a crash in Edinburgh on Princes Street, because he said, "Would you make up your mind, is that a goal or not?" So anyway, I'd done okay in these two games, and I got a chance to go, and David Francey and I did half of each half, and it was just a magical night. To be a Dons fan, without admitting I was ever a Dons fan until I retired in 2012, I like to think that people wouldn't have known. They all thought I was a Blue Nose, but of course people hear what they want to hear. The week after the Battershire game, I went to a match at Easter Road, and this guy says to me, "Oi, are you the guy that did the commentary on Wednesday night?" I said, "Yes," because you never knew what's coming. And he said, "You weren't half biased." I said, "Well, there aren't too many people from Belgium listening to the game. You Blue Noses are all the same," he said. So, you know, that in a nutshell is the historic campaign of 1983. And I can hardly believe, like you, it was 40 years ago.
Oh, it's scary indeed. I mean, before doing this podcast, looking through, I was googling around some of the Scottish club forums, and I tripped over a few, and a Hearts one, in particular, was trying to kind of like pin which team you supported, and they all got it wrong. They were all throwing out St Johnstone. You know, some were throwing out Rangers.
St Johnstone though?
Why is that?
The best game I ever did, and you'll hardly believe this, was St Johnstone against Airdrie. And it was a game that more or less decided who would take the title and go up. And the reason it was my favourite game was, on my way down the road, I went to see my old dad, who was in a nursing home in Crieth. And he was in tears when I got there. He said, "I've so enjoyed your commentary." And for that reason, that was my favourite game. So people might think St Johnstone because of that.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. I mean, Dave, I'll bring you in here. You know, the way that, you know, commentaries, especially on the radio as well, can, I don't know, it's almost kind of like a backdrop to an era or your youth or a certain time and place, in a way that TV commentaries don't. I mean, as you know, we all love the TV commentators as well. I mean, from an English watching perspective, you know, Barry Davis is the one for me, and always was in that respect. But the radio commentators always had that bigger job of being more descriptive, because you couldn't see the pictures and you had to summon them up in the head. You know, and within that, you know, it's an art form in itself.
I think that's the thing. It's kind of like, I always think of it as like music before they introduced videos. You know, when you used to buy music in the 60s and the 70s, yeah, you had to make your own pictures to go with it. And then in the 80s, they ruined it by everybody had to make a video for the single, and that was what the image of the thing was. And great radio commentary. I mean, it puts you in the place. But it, because you're not there, you're concentrating that much more fiercely than I think if you're watching it on television. You know, you've really got to pay attention if you really want to follow the game. And it's I think it's more indelibly marked on your brain somehow, you know, listening to radio commentary, than ever it can be with television. And, you know, that's not always good because we've heard a few bad commentaries over the years, but you know, I think
plenty of them, I'll tell you.
But and particularly with that European, that era of the European stuff in the 70s and into the 80s, obviously the technology was different then, and you know, there was some of the games from Eastern Europe, it was like listening to a couple of blokes commentating inside a biscuit tin. You know, it was just such terrible, but there was, you know, there was atmosphere and there was a warmth to that. And you're right, it does, you know, it's one of those things that does immediately sort of summon up your childhood when you think back to those.
But you're right about the rhythm of commentary. My first producer, as I said, Murdo McPherson, used to talk about try and get light and shade into your commentary, because otherwise it becomes a monotone. And that's no use. I liken it to the Brazilians. When I first saw Brazil play in 1982 in the World Cup, their fans, you know, gradually, they get the ball, and they play out. But they got to the penalty. You just knew where the ball was, just by the way the fans reacted, the drums went. It was fantastic, actually. It was absolutely fantastic. I sat alongside Eusebio that night. What a thrill. Somewhere in my attic, there should be a thing signed by Eusebio, because I thought, this is a legend. I mean, okay, I couldn't speak Portuguese as he spoke, but, you know, I'd never forget that game. Jock Steen had gone to watch and left a couple of minutes early without talking to any of the Scots press guys. But the colour, and that's what I then tried to bring into it. I mean, actually, the Dons game in Gothenburg came too early in my career. I was only a beginner. I'd hardly done 100 games, not even that many. And I got to go to the 82 World Cup because Radio 2, as it was in those days, said that they would rather have someone with my voice than David Francis, which was just crazy. I mean, it was such a shame that he didn't get to go there. So it was too early. And then, of course, I got fired from the BBC in the 1980s. And young Derek Ray, the name you know, he came in because they needed to get younger talent. And I just refused to go away. I said, well, okay, I'll go and do four for Stirling Albion. Or, you know, I'll be quite happy. You'd be happy doing that? I said, yeah, I'm quite happy to do reports, whatever. Because then, of course, the producer changes, the sports editor changes, and you get a chance again. And the next time you get a chance, you try and take it. So Gothenburg was almost too early for me. I think I did okay in it, but I would love to do it when I was really going strong towards the end of my career.
I mean, an amazing thing to have on your CV, though, David. I mean, alongside the 1982 World Cup and that Brazil game. I mean, and then that game in Malaga, I think it was. Was it Malaga? I think it was. One of our contemporaries at These Football Times, Stuart Horsfield, he's written a book on that Brazilian side at the 1982 World Cup. And we've spoken about this game, you know, incessantly over the years. Because that 82 World Cup was mine and his first World Cups. You know, we remember watching those as kids and being so enthralled by them. And, you know, the theory being that you're hardwired to those first World Cups that you remember. And you know, they set the tone for every disappointing World Cup to follow, basically. But we've always said about that Scotland team at the 82 World Cup, and obviously David Neary's goal, is that there's a glory to the Scotland side at that game that's, it's kind of like complicit by their association to the match. It's not that they're just the fall guys or the straight guy to kind of like Brazil's brilliant football. It's that they had the temerity to go out there and poke them with a stick in the first place.
And be then well beaten thereafter, you know. I mean, You can just think of the goal and Alan Ruff standing there as the free kick flashes past. That Brazilian team should have won that World Cup.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but within your litany of games covering Scotland, I mean, have there been many occurrences that I don't know, match up to that game against Brazil in terms of the occasion and the moment?
Yeah, McFadden in Paris and Scotland beating France 1-0, that was incredible. I finished out shouting, glory, glory, hallelujah, glory, glory, hallelujah. And, you know, rhyming off the team, and one man stood above them all, James McFadden. And it was just, I wasn't even commentating when he shot for goal. Willie Miller had been raveting on far too long, saying, we need to calm, this game needs to calm down. And next thing, boom, the ball's heading into the back of the net. So I picked it up from there. And then, of course, they had to hang on to try and get the victory. But what a night to be in Paris. That was amazing. That really was. The march out to the stadium and then the march back into Paris. The World Cup final was also won in 1998. That, although I wasn't French, the atmosphere inside the Stade de France that night was incredible. I did the game with my summariser in a studio in Glasgow and my pitch side guy in a studio in the middle of Paris. BBC Scotland didn't rate. We got one seat. and the other one that, for me, it was the most nerve-wracking was the 2006 World Cup final. When Zidane, of course, does his headbutt and it goes to the penalty shootout. And I've got no summariser. And they don't realise I actually can't see, because I'm at the very end, you know, miles away. And I've got a back on view. I've no television screen in front of me. People think you've got all the pictures that you need. And I needed somebody to reassure me who was taking each penalty kick. And I was kind of working them out by the colour of their boots. And honestly, the microphone was getting in and out and in and out and in and out. I was having to hang on to it. And I was so stressed. I would love to have known what my blood pressure was that night. For these kind of reasons, you know, these games stand out as well. Brazil was special. I had a problem, though. If Scotland qualified and had gone on to Barcelona, my career as the RNA's press officer would have been over, because I then had the decision to make. Did I stay on in Spain with the commentary alongside George Hamilton, or did I head back to Scotland and help to run the Open? Because that was really what I did for a living, at a wee PR company, and we ran media centres. And when Willie Miller and Alan Hansen tackled one another, I was quite relieved in the end of the day that we weren't going to qualify. Now, that's of course, I didn't want us not to qualify. I wanted us to qualify, but I really would have had a very difficult decision to make.
Oh, and even now, 40 years on, do you know which way you'd have been leaning there that day?
I would have tried to do both.
Right answer, I think.
Because I would have said to the team back in Glasgow, you need to hang on. I'll get home as quickly as I can. You can keep things going. Get preparations ready. Would have been burning the midnight oil to try and do both. But, you know, in those days, I was looking after 1,200 media people. So it was a big job running an Open Championship media centre. And I was right at the beginning of that career as well.
Oh, amazing stuff. I mean, Dave, you know, these stories of kind of like, yeah, being, you know, not even seeing, you know, the penalties, the 98 World Cup and sorry,
well, 2006,
yeah. Sorry, yeah. You know, it flies in the face of everything we as viewers and listeners imagine that the commentators go through, especially in such a, you know, rarefied occasion such as a FIFA event as a World Cup final.
It's not as glamorous as people think. I mean, I used to have to do, when I was working at West Brom, because nobody else would do it, I had to do some summarising for our radio commentator. Yeah, and you turn up and you don't know what you're going to get, do you? You know, you don't know what facilities you're going to find when you get there. You carry your little case with your ISDN kit in it. You get there and you offer up a silent prayer that everything's going to be okay. But I mean, yeah, I mean, you must have come across some real primitive places, shall we say, when it comes to press boxes.
Well, I did a commentary. Celtic were in Tel Aviv, and I was commentating from below the level of the ground. they stuck us in this little overflow dugout and said, get on with it. And we had a thing called a hot box on that particular night. And all I could see was Lars's head running along the far side. And then he went down. Oh, it's a definite penalty for Celtic. Must be a penalty. I had no idea what had happened. No idea. But of course, you got away with murder because it wasn't on TV. And I used to think with David Francie, when I first started working with him, he was a master. I used to think the ball was hanging under the bar every moment. You know, you'd be lying listening to a game that really meant something to you. It was only when I got to Hampden to work alongside him. Actually, the ball was out in the 18-yard line. Oh, it's underneath the bar. And he was way out in the middle of nowhere. It was just poetic license. And of course, he had amazing stories to tell as well. He had a little glass jar, and I always thought it was water that was in it until he spilled it one night. There was a bit of the amber nectar in there as well, and that's why he used to go three octaves up, you know. But these are happy times to look back on.
Oh, magnificent, utterly magnificent. I mean, David, you've already mentioned how you kind of stumbled into commentary in a way. You've got, you know, and you've already mentioned kind of like your associations with golf. But since commentary has come to an end, what fills your passions? What is it that drives you on?
Well, family. Don't get me started on that. I was doing quite well for a long time, and suddenly now I've had to come to a crashing halt. For the first 10 years, I was playing a lot of golf. I was going out on my bike and cycling off road. I was climbing hills, and you know that was really good. And then physically, I no longer can do that, which is such a shame. But I still take a passionate interest in sport as an armchair critic. And believe it or not, for someone who used to call rugby egg chasing, I've become a very passionate Glasgow Warriors rugby fan. I have a season ticket for Glasgow Warriors. It's a bit long to go up to Aberdeen and try and watch the Dons. And I really, really enjoy going to the rugby because there's no hatred, there's no bile, it's a family environment. Glasgow, when they're at their best, play bright, open rugby. So that's also ticking my boat. My wife thinks I do nothing but watch sport. I'm a mad keen cricket fan because we had a wee cricket club in Afford as well. And we had a wee Australian pro who got us so enthused about the game of cricket. And Richie Benno became a friend through the years. So I've always enjoyed watching cricket. I could spend 8 hours happily in the course of the day when they get in there at 10:30, first ball at 11 o'clock, they analyse the game till 6:30, and I never leave the place. I love watching cricket. People say, why cricket? Because there's something could happen. It could happen every ball.
I mean, across your career, did you ever branch out from you know, in terms of reporting and commentary, away from football? You know, such a passion for multi-sports.
The first shinty match I ever saw, I did a commentary on. Now, you might not know what shinty is, but it's a big man's hockey, really. And I went to a training session, and this guy, Donald Skinner, explained the detail of the game to me. So I did do other sports. I did a bit of golf commentary on Sky Television in 1998. Sadly, just when I thought this would be the future for me, because I retired from my own business in 1997, and in 1998 I got an opportunity to do a couple of tournaments for Sky, and this guy said, look, when it comes to the rota for next season, you're definitely going to be included. You'll get a good number of gigs. Lo and behold, he left or got fired, I'm not sure which, and the new guy didn't know about this commitment. And so that just dried up right away. I also did Radio Scotland's coverage of the Open when it was played in Scotland. The late, great Renton Laidlaw was a colleague for those Opens. And they were great fun. I loved it because the Open was deep in my soul. It really was. By the time I'd finished in 1997, I just loved that golf championship.
Going back to the dry period after Derek Ray takes over the main commentaries on BBC Scotland, Were there ever any thoughts of leaving the BBC at all? I mean,
well, I was only a freelance. I mean, I was never employed by the BBC. I never went into the building other than to do a report. You just know that somewhere down the line, if he's good, he'll move on. Because he's moved on and had a wonderful career in America, and now is covering the German Bundesliga. So I was prepared to hang around and see what happened. But that wasn't, that was almost like a hobby, because the main business was running media centres. You know, we did the Benson and Hedges, the Dunhill Cup, Monte Carlo Open. Eventually, I finished up doing a tournament. You can see his picture behind me, Gene Sarazen, the Sarazen World Open. So I used to travel around the world, tournaments in Malaysia. And so that was the main business. We also ran little amateur golf tournaments, and then quite a big one for a company called Famous Grouse, you have heard of. So that provided the income stream. But right at the beginning, I had no money. I mean, I had a pregnant wife, a car that had done 120,000 miles, and earned £250 in the first 6 months in business. Well, that wasn't going to work, was it? So I had to find other things to do. And so the other things were running media centres. And I got a couple of good breaks, no doubt about that. But then a fallout with Ken Schofield. And so my European tour career more or less comes to a crashing halt. But IMG were really supportive and gave me a lot of work through the World Match Play Championship and the Dunhill and the Women's British Open. So, you know, things were still ticking along okay. But I have to say, the whole thing has been a privilege. I mean, it was a privilege to be in Gothenburg, and it's been a privilege to work in sport. I wanted to be a pro golfer when I was 15, and my father said, "Nah, no future in golf. You'll go to university." I said, "Okay, smart aleck, what do you want me to do at university?" He said, "Well, what do you want to do?" I said, "I'd like to become a doctor." "Oh, you should have taken science in school." I said, "Well, so what am I going to do then?" And he was quite a strong-willed fella. So my first job was as a salesman after I graduated from Glasgow Uni. First job was as a salesman, working for Burroughs Machines, selling computer systems. And my mother, every weekend, would say, "When are you getting a real job?" She didn't think that was a real job, but it paid very well. I then became the PGA Scottish Region Secretary because I wanted to work in sport. After that ended, because I fined Bernard Gallagher £10 for not wearing a tie at a prize giving. And that hit the front pages and the back pages. And I read about the fine being overturned in the Herald without anybody telling me. So I said to the guys, "Well, you can stick your job where the sun shines." And that was me then going out on my own. I hadn't planned it. Anne was pregnant with our second child, huge overdraft, big mortgage, inflation rates running 10-15%. You can remember back to those days. You're too young, the two of you, to remember that.
I know, I can remember.
It was horrendous. But we muddled through, we skimped and saved, cut corners, bought clothing for the daughter in jumbo sales, and gradually got back in an even keel. But I've been very lucky. I mean, I wanted to work in sport. I had a job in Canada as a pro golfer. I would never have made it as a player, but I might have been quite a decent teacher. And that was what I really wanted to do. But what I've done has been a very good second best.
I mean, Dave, a wonderful story that David's got there with, you know, it's the way that doors will open and close, you know, almost simultaneously sometimes that can guide a career like this.
Yeah, you've got to be ready to take your opportunity, and you've got to be good. That's the main thing. You've got to be good so that you know, you can grab it when it comes along. I mean, going back to that sort of period, the Dons in Europe and all of that, how did you do your preparation before the games? Because obviously, you know, we hadn't got the internet and we hadn't got, you know, all that stuff that you can just tap into now. I mean, when they're playing Watershire, for instance, in the semi-final, I mean, nobody had ever heard of them, had they?
No, but it's amazing what you can find out from the managers. And Fergie was very good to me. I don't know why, because I was a real rookie, but he was really good to me. For example, in Gothenburg, he told me exactly how the Dons were going to play and what Real Madrid would do. And I eventually evolved a sticker system, but most of it was handwritten. Most of it was up here. And it's like a hen's march to the midden. I mean, the commentary notes from Gothenburg are absolutely primeval compared to what it became. I also got a lot of help from, say, moving on an era to Walter Smith. He would make all the videos and CDs that he had available from the support guy, Steve Harvey. He would make them available to me. So I used to spend hours watching videos of opposition. And there was one particular one where I got a video of somebody in one of the Moscow teams. We got in stand and said, "Where did you get that?" I said, "Well," and I'd got it actually from Steve Harvey of Rangers. He said, "I could have done with that." I said, "Well, there you go. If you'd been nice to me, maybe you'd have got it." So I used to spend a lot of time watching videos. How did people run? Where did they play? What runs did they make? You rely on your summarizer to tell you a lot, but it helped if I knew what I was watching. I had over 2,000 games I was lucky enough to do. And a number of years ago, I did the first clear out. And we raised money for a charity called SANE, because people would say, have you got the notes of such and such a game? Yes, I've got that note. And so I would send them the original copy, and gradually I whittled it down. We raised about 3,500, just flogging off my old notes, and people would make donations to it. And I had stickers for every player, and I like to put my stickers down in number order. Other people make stickers. You look at Clive Tilsley's notes, they're magnificent. He had everybody already beautifully handwritten, beautifully presented. So did Motti, actually. I waited till I got the team sheet, and then for 5 minutes, got the stickers and put them down the page. And I then had another sheet, and the very top there is the way the team would play. And how you get that is the Celtic manager that night was Martin O'Neill with John Robertson. And Steve Woolford, who was part of the triumvirate, and a very successful, he would always tell me what was going to happen. He would slip me, this is going to be the team. So other people like Ian Crocker of Sky, also very helpful. Whatever I got, I would give to Ian. Ian would give to me. And neither of us would take it any further. And the managers could tell us things in confidence that they knew we wouldn't mention until the game started. So you got a lot of trust from the managers. As I say, in the early days, Fergie was very good to me. There was one game, and we had to get the managers to come up to the point at the back of the stand after the match to record the post-match interview. And I had forgotten to flick the switch to start the ewer running to do the recording, by which time Fergie's back downstairs again. So I had to go way back down. Alec, "I'm sorry. Could you come back up and redo it?" "Yeah, bastard." I said, I'm sorry, it won't happen again. And of course, Fergie, you would occasionally get the full treatment from Fergie. There was one day after a Scottish Cup final, he's coming out of being the summariser with Archie McPherson for television, and he spots me, and he starts giving me dog's abuse. "I thought you were a pal. Don't you ever come back to me. You're banned from Pittodrie." I said, "What are you talking about? You said we assassinated Peter Grant." "You'd got the wrong David. It was David Francie." And I said to him, "Alec, I wasn't even at that game. I was at Morton 1, Dundee 1. Just ask your pal, Archie Knowles." "Oh, were you? You're still banned," he said. But he was so helpful in these early days. I was just a beginner. I could understand him dealing with a David Francie like that. But, you know, he had real class at Fergie. He was so relaxed before that game, though. I think he knew they would win. He just believed they would win. I mean, got rid of Byam in the quarterfinals. So that was the major hurdle. And right through the years, Walter Smith was very helpful as well. Martin O'Neill, not so much, but his sidekicks, John Robertson and Wolford, were very helpful. Gordon Strachan was a nightmare. Neil Lennon was very helpful. So you rely on some managers you got on with. Alex Smith of Aberdeen couldn't do enough for you. Absolutely couldn't do enough. You got everything. What do you need? And it was fantastic to have that relationship with manager.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, you can't imagine that type of close cooperation could possibly go on in a contemporary setting.
I think you'd be surprised. I think it does.
You think it does,
Yeah, I think if you get the respect of the managers and you get the trust of the managers, they will trust you back.
It can still happen.
It'll still happen. You know, the good broadcasters will know what they're doing. That's why some guys get all the interviews, because they know exactly what they're doing. It's more difficult because there are all sorts of media PRs who decide nowadays who's up for interview. And you might not want that person, whereas in my time, it was different. We asked for a guy and we got him. It was much less interference by the PR department. It didn't exist. It was a manager who said you could get him or not get him. And so you had to work with the managers. And as I say, that time with Fergie was just a magical time.
Did you do the Scottish Cup final a week after?
I did.
Openers Cup, because he wasn't in the best of moods then, was he, after
wasn't,
the game?
Because Graeme Stewart asked him a question. He lost the plot. I mean, it wasn't as if they had lost. They won the Cup. And he later apologised to the players for losing it. But he thought they were a disgrace, he had said to Graeme. And we couldn't believe what we were seeing in that interview. But that was typical Fergie. You know, he'd set high standards. And I don't suppose he wanted Dundee United to win the league either. That wouldn't have gone down very well with him.
It is a minefield, though, after a game, isn't it, going and interviewing a manager? Because you never quite know what they're going to react.
Yeah, I think they should maybe wait. I always felt this about golfers as well. They should wait 10 to 15 minutes before they say anything. Just give themselves time. But, of course, the rush nowadays is to get interviews as soon as possible. I used to sometimes, if it was a bad performance, a bad result, I wouldn't go near him. I'll call to you tomorrow, give you a phone. You know, and it was good that you could do that, because I used to do a column in the Daily Express, first and second division roundups, under the name Hugh Mack. Now, my predecessor in the column was actually a guy called Hugh McKinley, but he saw I was struggling. He said, look, I'm thinking that taking a back seat, why don't you continue my call? And that got me talking to managers as they were coming through. I really enjoyed that time. You know, you talked to Ali McLeod, who was down at Ayr United at that point. And so, you're beginning to get a feel for the grassroots of football. A lot of the guys from the newspaper boys used to say to me, what do you know about football? I knew very little. Did you play the game? I said, well, I played the combined reserve league for the university team. Oh, well, that's all right then. But they didn't like a new boy coming in, the old Jimmy Roger, who was the doyen of football writers in Scotland, and the Jimmy Roger Media Centre, I think, still exists in Hamden. And he was giving me a really hard time. You're stealing our questions. You're stealing our answers. Get out of here. And I said, you're really talking about it. So the next time I was at Tannadice, Jimmy was struggling for a lift home. So I went to him and said, Jimmy, would you like a lift home to Shorts? Shorts was nowhere near where I was going. But having spent an hour and a half with him in the car, well, then like that. And I joined his press fund. He's a great advocate of the press fund, which looks after journalists that have fallen on hard times. And I took out a life membership in the press fund. And that was Jimmy Rogers sorting. He just had to work with people, you know.
Would you say you were in the perfect place at the right time with your radio commentary, the birth of your radio commentary career? I mean, Aberdeen, but you know, Dundee United, that new firm as it became known.
No, it was too early in my career. I honestly didn't know what I had. It was such a special time for these two clubs. And I really didn't appreciate. I hadn't been to a single football match for 6 years. You know, when I got married in 1974, my first game was that Rangers-Celtic test piece with Roddy Forsyth. So I wasn't a football fan. I was too busy trying to keep a house together. And in those days, I was the PGA secretary until the autumn of 1979. And it just happened by accident. So I was lucky, really lucky to get a start. I was even luckier to get a second go at it. And my best years, without any doubt, in terms of commentary, were the final 12 until I became unwell in 2010. And then more or less had to give up. I was really struggling with my mental health at that point.
I mean, you mentioned your battles with mental health there, David. How profound, was that experience?
Oh, the terrible thing. It first happened in 1995, 96, and I got a lot of good help from a very good consultant who used to listen to me on the radio and said, "I'll get you sorted, don't you worry." And he did. But when I went over the edge again in 2010, it was really hard. And hard on the people around me, hard on the family, you know. Very, very difficult for family members to cope with. And there's no logic to it. It's just one of these things that happens. Touch wood, I've been okay for the last 8 years, but you never ever assume anything about mental health. And that's why the charity scene was one I was very keen to support. And in fact, I really wanted to get it more support and get a black dog in Glasgow called Doug the dog from Glasgow, because this charity, basically their symbol was the black dog, which is, if you go back to Churchill, we talked about having the black dog, take the dog for a walk. And so it's a little charity. It's not one of the great big mental health charities, but they are there for people when people need a call. They can send them text messages or whatever. You cannot do enough to get out into the open. There was a doctor, Ian Smith, was attached to Inverness Caledonian Thistle, and he said, "How are you doing?" I said, "I'm struggling." He said, "I can see that." He said, "You know, it's good to talk." And Neil Lennon had struggled with his mental health. He was like another kindred spirit, and he got me through a couple of episodes as well. It's more common than you would think, and people shouldn't shut it away. They should bring it out into the open, talk about it, and then try and get something done about it. Because there's always a future. You know, the future is, and you don't think there's a future when you really are crashing down and lying in a hospital bed. Well, I've got 4 grandchildren, so that was good.
Brilliant. I mean, Dave, it's an amazing thing that David can be so candid about his problems, but also to have been such a focal point in Scottish football as well, to be so out there as well. You know, it has to have been, some amazing chasms to bridge at times.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd be very proud of it, the being able to talk about it and bringing it out into the open, because there's a lot of people who obviously suffer in silence with all of this. And, as you said, the money that you were able to raise with your notes and stuff, I mean, that's a fantastic thing. You must be very proud of that.
Well, it's not nearly as much as I should have done. I should have done more about it. But at that time, it seemed the right thing to do. But, you look at the rugby player this week helping his mate, and the money that Doddy Weir raised, each one has its own cause. And it's fantastic what these guys do. They really do make a difference. You know, when that Gothenburg trip, the vice chairman of Aberdeen was Chris Anderson. And, of course, he suffered from motor neuron disease in the end. And he said, there'll be a cure, because he said, there's great work being done in Newcastle. And this, he said, there'll be a cure within 10 years. Well, we're 40 years down the line. It was incredible to think that he was the future of Aberdeen Football Club. Dick Donald, who absolutely piloted the whole thing through the Fergie era, had a great number two in Chris Anderson. Really, he was a top, top guy. And it's terrible that these diseases do exist and we haven't yet got a cure for them. We'll get there. I mean, it'll happen at some point. I don't know when it'll happen. But that's another thing, sitting in the airport with Chris Anderson, talking to him about his future. And that was quite humbling, actually.
You mentioned Chris Anderson. I mean, I suppose people forget a little bit now, but I mean, they were such a go-ahead club, weren't they?
Oh,
I mean, when Fergie first joined, they were straight off to America to see what they could learn from there, and the all-seater stadium and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know, there were 24,000 at that game against Bayern Munich. It's just extraordinary. You look now, the capacity was a sellout on Saturday for the Hibs game. It was only 18 and a bit. I don't know what happened to the other 6,000, or whether they were horseshoed in. In some way, I think there used to be a bit of a what we used to call the Weir Gate in Hampden a few extra guys would turn up. You always see a lot of people standing at the back of the terrace. Ian Taggart was the club secretary at that point. And I often wonder how on earth all these guys, I said, where are they coming from? They may have redesigned Pittodrie, they may have put in more comfortable seating. It certainly wasn't very comfortable for us that night. We used to sit in one of the commentary boxes for television for the normal games on a Saturday. But for midweek European, we're tuffed into the main stand and sat in the back with your notes in your lap and your drink and you spill that all over you. I mean, Murdo McLeod, who's struggling with his health at the moment, he and I were over in the new camp and one of the Celtic fans spotted Murdo. Oh, Murdo. And he starts to climb in the window of the commentary box. This is before the game starts. However, he doesn't see that my little drink is there, and he knocks my drink all over my notes, which were in felt pen and ran. All I had was this mush of notes. And we were actually behind the goal line in the new camp. It was a fantastic view, but it was a long, long way from one end of the pitch to the other. And I had no notes now. And this guy, Douglas, I'll never forget his name. I said, you swine. Can you see what you've done? But I used to have a beggy rant. It was known as the rant.
Oh, magnificent. I mean, going full circle to Aberdeen 82-83. I mean, where does Alex Ferguson and Aberdeen's achievement in winning the Cup Winners' Cup, you know, ranking in your opinion amongst not only Scottish achievement, but, you know, British football achievements in European football?
Oh, I think it's amazing. I mean, I know they were of their time, and the gap between the haves and the have-nots wasn't as massive as it is now. I mean, it could never happen that an Aberdeen like that would compete at the top level. When you look at the English Premiership, full houses, players getting obscene amounts of money. But, you know, Aberdeen were able to take Mark McGee back north. He picked clever players to suit his plan. And for them to dominate those 5 years from 1980 through to 85, and that in the middle of it all, was incredible. I mean, Real Madrid weren't the Real Madrid of the Champions Cup, European Cup. But you see, it was Cup Winners' Cups. It wasn't the same old, same old, same old as we get at the moment. It's too small now, I think. The pool of top clubs is too small. But, you know, Aberdeen just could beat what was in front of them, and they managed to beat Bayern Munich and Real Madrid of that era. That was incredible. Dundee United would have gone on to do something very similar, but for a corrupt referee. There's no doubt about that. It was a very special time. You had Ferguson, you had Steen, and you had McLean all together. Three of the very best managers in the business. And people doubted Fergie. And he was only a game away from, well, we thought, getting Heathrow from Old Trafford. And he dropped Jim Leighton. That was a key decision, and the rest is history. All the trophies he won. I mean, he had a chance to go to Rangers, but he didn't want to go for various reasons. Thank goodness he didn't go, in a sense, because he then achieved this huge legacy. But it started even at St Mirren. It started at East Stirlingshire, actually, for Fergie. And wherever he went, he built on his experience and brought that to bear. And he had a very special group of players at Aberdeen. I mean, Miller and McLeish were incredible defenders. They knew how to defend. Rhys Strachan was a clever little player. Alec knew what he needed. The loss of Kennedy for the final was a bit of a blow. Yeah, and he said that, but it was an opportunity for someone else, the groupie. But, you know, Ferguson, I think it's up there, but it's of a different time. But for Aberdeen fans, it is the pinnacle. There's no doubt about that.
It has to be the moment, doesn't it? I mean, it's an incredible era. I mean, I think he win three league titles, three or four Scottish Cups, a League Cup, you know, and the Cup Winners' Cup, and it tends to fall under the radar. There was a European Super Cup in there, and as holders in 83-84, they went to the semi-finals.
I remember saying to him, don't you move on until you've smashed the old firm monopoly or duopoly. And of course, it's 1985 was the last time anybody other than Celtic or Rangers won the league in Scotland. That's horrific. I believe if Ferguson had stayed at Aberdeen, that wouldn't be the case. But they are massive compared to all the other clubs up here now. But all the other clubs are playing for third place, which is such a shame. Alex Smith had a chance to win the league in 1990, but for a very bad refereeing decision, he might have done it. But Theo Schnelders also said he wasn't fit when he was actually 95% fit. And young Michael Watt was putting goal, and Hatley rattled his cage in the very first minute. He should have been sent off, actually, but Brian McGinley wouldn't send him off. It's a hard thing to send off a Rangers striker at Ibrox. A lead decider.
I mean, Dave, that was that 83 Cup Winners' Cup winning side, though, was amazingly balanced, wasn't it? I mean, the defending of Miller and McLeish, you know, that triangular defensive unit with Jim Leighton behind them, you know, midfield that scored goals galore. You know, it wasn't just Gordon Strachan, but you know, there was Simpson that added goals there as well. You know, he wasn't the only one. Hewitt, you know, the perpetual 12th man, seemingly, it was talismanic in the Cup Winners' Cup that year. You know, this is one of the best sides that has ever been produced in Scottish football.
I think so. I think it says a lot of Ferguson's bravery as well. I mean, your central midfield is Neil Simpson and Neil Cooper. And they were kids. I mean, Cooper was 19, wasn't he? I think Simpson was 21. I mean, to play those two in your centre midfield in a European final, I mean, that takes, you know, that takes some doing, doesn't it? And I think he gave people belief in themselves, didn't he? I mean, that seems to me to be his greatest gift. He's, you know, it was, you can play, you can go and do it, you know, you know there was the hairdryer and all that stuff as well, but that Aberdeen side was very much like that first really great Manchester United side that won the Premier League. It had got, you know, the width with Strachan and particularly with Peter Weir on the other side, you know, in the same way that they had Kanchelskis and Giggs in that Manchester United team. Great strength all the way through. Someone was telling a story last week that they knew they'd got Real Madrid beat in the tunnel because Madrid looked at them and they saw that none of the players had got any teeth. And they all thought, oh my God, what have we come
to? What have we got ourselves into? I mean, that Real Madrid side, though, I mean, it was led by Alfredo Di Stefano and they famously finished second in everything they went for that season. They fumbled the title.
Atletico Bilbao won the title.
They were in a strong position but then fumbled it to Bilbao. They lost the Copa del Rey final. And this was during an eye of the storm where I think it only lasted for 3 years, but Spain had a League Cup for a short few years, 3 or 4 years in the early to mid-1980s, and they lost the final as that as well, to go along with losing the Cup Winners' Cup final. It wasn't a vintage Real Madrid side, but this was still a Real Madrid side that had played in the European Cup final just 2 years earlier to Liverpool, against Liverpool. It was, you know, I still think a stunning achievement that stands up to, I think, any achievement by a British club in European football, David.
Yeah, I mean, every other club who's won a trophy will tell you that their achievement was just as good. It means a lot to us because, I mean, Aberdeen won 2 European trophies. They won the Super Cup as well, remember, which no other club in Scotland can say that. But, you know, you go back to 67 and the Celtic Lisbon Lions, they were all born and brought up within 35 miles of Glasgow, which was amazing. I mean, think of that nowadays. There's hardly a club in Scotland that's got more than 2 or 3 Scots playing for it. We've still farmed them in from down south and all over. In England, you know, how many international players in each of the major squads? But there was Celtic. I mean, that was the achievement. They broke the mould. How could a club with homegrown players do that? Aberdeen certainly had all Scots, but you know, it was, they weren't small in their own minds because Dick Donald was a very wealthy man, and the oil boom was hitting Aberdeen. If he needed another player, he would sell another plot of land. He had enough vision to have, you know, generated wealth, not just from his theatre, but, you know, he knew what the market was liable to be. And so if Fergus needed money, he got money. So they were wealthy in relative terms compared to the other clubs that were around at that time. Rangers Cup winners, Cup in Barcelona, was that a great achievement? It probably was. But they were a big club. It was expected. It wasn't expected that Aberdeen would get past the quarterfinals. They had done well to go to Germany and stay in the game. And to then come back from 2-1 down with 15 minutes to go at Pittodrie was unbelievable. And they got Real Madrid at the right time. As you said, they were coming off the disappointment of not getting the league. But they knew they would play with pride. And that was what Ferguson drilled into his men. He didn't want his team to remember anything about the game because he wanted them to concentrate. That's got to be the key. You can celebrate after it's all over, but concentrate. You can win this.
Amazing stuff. I mean, it's a testament, Dave, to that success that Aberdeen had, you know, both domestically and in Europe, that a year later when they faced Porto in the semi-finals again, they were deemed the favourites to go through to the final before falling at the final hurdle. In the opposite semi-final in 84 stood Manchester United. We were denied the tantalising prospect of an Aberdeen-Manchester United 1984 Cup Winners' Cup final. That, I mean, that was an incredible season as well. I mean, Liverpool went all the way in the European Cup. Dundee United were, shall we say, ushered to the exit.
This was all
on the very same day. All three European competitions, the semi-finals took place on the same day. Yeah, Dundee United's lost to Roma. Manchester United and Aberdeen going out the Cup Winners' Cup. There was also the UEFA Cup. Spurs made it through to the final, and Nottingham Forest would go out to Anderlecht in a great deal of shade. But yeah, that potential 84 Aberdeen-Manchester United final that never quite was, Dave, one of the great what-ifs.
Yeah, that would have been something, wouldn't it, to play that one of those typical Battle of Britain games. Of course, Aberdeen had played Liverpool, hadn't they, four years earlier in the European Cup. And that was, Ferguson always used to say that was the one where they learned more than anything, because obviously the great Liverpool side took them apart, particularly at Anfield, and from there they started to put it together as a side. That would have been some game though, and I think Aberdeen would have beat Manchester United. I think they would have defended the Cup Winners' Cup. I think, you know, again, some of the interviews from last week for this Freedom of the City and stuff, the Aberdeen players were livid really with themselves that they didn't win the league that year in 83. Because had they gone into the European Cup rather than Dundee United, they felt they would have gone on and won the European Cup. Because, I mean, you know, they were...
Who did they,
by the end of the year, they were the number one.
Somebody beat Aberdeen. Who was it? St Mirren, Partick Thistle. Was it St Mirren that cost them the league? But as I said, my memory gets a bit hazy when I go back in time, you know. But they certainly had a belief about them. They knew that they could keep on winning the league up here. And he was annoyed, especially because it was just down the road that they'd won it.
I mean, it was amazingly vibrant era, a wonderfully competitive era for Scottish domestic football as well. I mean, that Hearts side that blew the double in 85-86, you know, famously lost the title on the final day and then lost to Ferguson's Aberdeen in the 86 Scottish Cup final. You know, Jim McLean's Dundee United, you know, Celtic still, you know, mixing it. If anything, Rangers were the poor relatives at that point in time. I always seem to... As a child of the late 70s and early 80s, when we'd watch a cup final on the television, we'd always get the footage of, and by the way, at Hampden, this is what happened. And it always seemed like Rangers were the team that were kind of like, I don't know, they were the punchline to everyone else's good day out at that point in time. I always associated Rangers to dysfunction of the early 1980s. But yeah, across the board, that was a wonderfully competitive era. You say it came too soon, but it offered so much.
Yeah, the Rangers setup was all wrong. Of course, they then brought in David Murray's money, and he brought Souness up and a whole raft of top English players, Chris Woods and Terry Butcher, and you know, you can go through a list of English internationals, Trevor Stephen. At what a cost to the club, I don't know. I mean, it just, they kept on spending and they didn't have the money. I mean, Dick Advocaat spending zillions on Torrey Andrew Flo, and Gret eventually, of course, they go into liquidation in 2012. David Murray was determined there would be a challenge from Rangers, but you're right, the early 80s, they were really poor. Really poor. Small crowds. You go to Ibrox and it'd be, you know, a third full. Whereas Aberdeen and Dundee United were buoyant. Celtic were having problems behind the scenes until Fergus McCann came in and sorted them out to go from the Kelly regime. I mean, these are generalities I'm giving you, but you know, it was the right time for Aberdeen and Dundee to be around because the old firm, as they were called then, were gravely weakened. So it was a good time to make hay. But they could do it at a high level, as we know, with what they achieved in both cases, and then what Dundee United achieved against Gothenburg a couple of years later. They just had far too many games that season for such a small squad. I think they actually had about 21 players that played, but you know, 7 or 8 of those played under a handful of games, and they relied on 14 or 15 players to see them through this huge campaign, home and away in Europe, league matches, cup runs, and some of the guys were playing 60 games if you included internationals.
I mean, Dundee United at that point in time as well, David, I mean, they're the team in Scottish football that I always had a soft spot for as a kid. I used to love the orange shirts and the, you know, the black shorts, that combination. You know, and we'd get goals on Football Focus, on Grandstand and stuff like that. And Paul Sturrock and Eamon Bannon always used to seem to score screamers every week. And they were just very evocative. And I had a lot of respect for that Aberdeen side, but it was that Dundee United side that had my soft spot. What was the difference between, because Aberdeen seemed to win so much more than Dundee United did. Dundee United, you know, that loss of the 87 UEFA Cup final, they always seem to lose in the Scottish Cup final, you know, 87 when they lost to St Mirren as well. And, you know, there were a litany of mischief. For every trophy they won, they seemed to miss out on a couple. Whereas Aberdeen seemed to have that ruthlessness to be able to win more than they lost. You know, what was the differences between, you know, Jim McLean's Dundee United and Alex Ferguson's Aberdeen that made that the way it was?
I think it was down to the managers and the kind of belief that Ferguson had was that little bit more than Jim had. Jim did believe, but then he would take Jock Steen along for the ride and try and pick his brains, whereas Ferguson would be his own man.
Knew his own mind.
Very much his own man. He would still have Jock Steen way back in the setup talking to him, but Jim had Steen alongside him at times, and I didn't think that worked. Jim was at his best when he was the man and he was calling the shots, and of course the players were almost in fear of him because their contracts were ridiculous at Tannadice. But I think it would come down to the two managers. Ferguson would make the big call when it mattered. He knew the right time to do something. He knew the right player to sign to fill a gap. And he had the backing of the chairman. Dick Donald was a wonderful chairman. I'm not saying the people at Dundee United weren't good people. Eddie Thompson and people like that who came after Jim or around the same time. But Dick Donald knew exactly. He was quiet, very calm. Okay, what do you need? Yes, right, we'll get you that. And so Ferguson could go and buy Mark McGee and bring him up. I think he was at Newcastle, wasn't he? He's certainly playing in England and suddenly appears in the Aberdeen centre. So, you know, I think Ferguson, you have to say Ferguson was the one who made the difference.
I mean, Dave, watching a documentary as part of in the days before recording this podcast, there's some wonderful... is it wonderful? It looks harsh. Some of the training techniques that Alex Ferguson kind of inflicted upon his players.
Yeah, I was interested listening to, you know, the likes of Gordon Strachan and John McMaster and Alex McLeish relating all of that stuff that Ferguson did to him in training. I mean, he'd probably be arrested now. I don't know about being the greatest manager of all time. They'd be marching him off to the police station, and there'd be players talking about bullying and all sorts. I mean, seriously, that is a very fine line in football, isn't it? You know,
you wouldn't get away with that now.
No, absolutely not.
Absolutely not get away with it. I mean, Walter Smith and the guys would go into the boot room and have a square goal, and he would tell you that. I don't know what went on. I didn't witness any of that firsthand, but you just would not get away with that. Players would just look at you and say, well, goodbye. But you see, you know, Ferguson at Manchester United wouldn't take any opposition. So, yap, stamp, down the road. If there's a guy who's disrupting the dressing room, he knew how to treat him. Get rid of him. Because there's only one boss. And he was ruthless in that sense. Absolutely ruthless.
I mean, they were all terrified of him, clearly, but all had enormous respect. So Alex McLeish was telling a story last week about, I think it was around 85, 86, he'd been tapped up by Tottenham, and he wanted to move. And he got to sign a new contract, and he was hoping that Ferguson would go on holiday before he had to come in and sign this contract. But Ferguson demanded that he came in at the end of the season. So he got his wife to drive him in, and she said, right, just tell him that we're off to London, we're going to Tottenham. So McLeish goes into the office, sits down, and Ferguson says, I want you to sign this contract. Oh, it's okay, boss, you go on holiday, and we'll do it when you come back. No, I want it now, I want it off my mind before I go on holiday. So McLeish says, well, you're not paying me enough. You and Miller, you're bleeding this club dry. I'll tell you what, I'll give you another tenner a week. So he signed the contract, went back to his wife. He said, so when are we moving? She said, when are we moving to London? Oh, no, he's got me to sign on for another 3 years. they seem terrified of him, but have enormous respect for him and, you know, would run through brick walls for him at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that happened with Celtic and Jock Steen as well. That, you know, the players would say to Billy McNeil, you need to go and speak to the boss. And McNeil would go along and speak to Jock and come back with his tail between his legs. Well, how did it go? Aye, just the same money. We're not getting an increase. Because that's what these managers did. They had a huge presence. Huge presence. I mean, I don't know what Guardiola and Klopp and all these guys are like now. But do they get involved in the detail of that? Agents go in, they negotiate. The player doesn't sit opposite the manager trying to negotiate his terms. The agent's done the business. It's a different world, an absolutely different world.
Without a shadow of a doubt. Well, this has been a wonderful hour and a quarter, David, to spend talking to you about so much more than just Aberdeen and 1983. You've been a wonderful guest for us on the podcast, and thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Good luck in your future podcast, and I'll look out for the magazine.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you about. I think it was probably an era when you were able to do your job more than maybe radio commentators are allowed to do today, with, as you say, all the media, PR, and all that kind of stuff. It was a different world. I think a better one. I think
it was a good time. It was a good time, and it had been a privilege to be part of it all for so many years. I mean, I did it for 32 years, and it was a real privilege to be part of it. So thanks for inviting me on.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for your time, David. It's been great to see, you know, to hear, you know, the stories and the characters and the moments that you've enjoyed. Well, thank you just to once more to the listeners as well. This has been Today's Football Times from These Football Times. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.